Dear future, I'm ready to love. Everything starts with love. It's the most powerful emotion that we have.
This is Dear Future, I'm Ready, a podcast brought to you from Amsterdam by Digital Society School and Transformational Studio. Your hosts for today are Carola Vashore and Marco van Hout.
Hello and welcome to a new episode. While you listen probably on the go, you don't have to worry about taking notes. We've got that all covered. So when you visit our podcast page on digitalsocietyschool.org, you will find a full transcript, links, and more information for your own reference and to refer the inspirational content to your friends and colleagues. Today we will speak with Philip McKenzie. Philip is born and bred in what he terms real Brooklyn. He's an anthropologist who uses his expertise in culture to advise organizations on how best to thrive in an increasingly challenging and uncertain environment. Philip uses his quantitative background and Wall Street experience in combination with a qualitative understanding of social, economic, and cultural movements to unmask complex opportunities and identify significant trends that impact and uncover viable futures. Philip is a content creator and writer. He is the current executive director of Advancing Diversity and a columnist for Media Village. He's the creator and host of The Deep Dive, a leading culture and insights podcast. He is completing his first book titled No Shortcuts, The Revolutionary's Guide to the Future. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Thank you so much for having me. I am beyond excited to be here and have this conversation.
That's so lovely, Phil. It's awesome to have you here. It's always exciting to speak to you, and I'm as well very much looking forward to how this conversation will unfold. As you know, our podcast is called 21 for 21, and it's a podcast about transformation. And transformation is happening right now, everywhere it seems, and it's quite mind-boggling. So we like to talk to transformational leaders that help us make sense of it all. Obviously, we're super inspired and we regularly listen to your podcast, The Deep Dive, where there's a lot of wisdom as well. And today we kind of want to turn the tables and have you as a guest of our podcast and help us by inspiring us in our own transformational journeys and those of our audience. That's why we want to talk to you about revolutions, about system change, taking bold steps and diving deep in order to thrive. So what do you make of all of the chaos and transformative kind of gruesome, violent movements around us these days?
Yeah, that's an easy one. I'm glad we started off with the simplest question possible. I definitely think about this stuff all the time. And I think as we all should, because we're all living in it. I don't know how much of it is actually chaotic. I think much of it is quite by design, in the sense that, you know, these systems are acting as they should. Capitalism is a extractive, exploitative system predicated in violence. And when you look around and you see how the world is operating, it's operating in that manner. So it's not, in my mind, surprising at all. The transformational shift will be, if it's going to happen, will be when we move away from a system that exploits and introduce a system that does not.
Which is, again, speaking about starting off with the simplest issues, which is a hell of a job, of course. In the end, I think that this whole experience is very humbling, in the sense that we start realizing that we only see a fraction of what's really happening. Perhaps the sense of chaos comes from the fact that we have to face uncertainty and the unknown as such as ever before. Perhaps we were under the illusion that we understood things when in fact we didn't, or we had a very skewed, biased way of looking at the world. Do you think that might be the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of us are comfortable with complexity in the sense that we understand that systems are connected. They're connected to different degrees. And so when you're looking at a complex system, you're understanding bits and pieces of it. And there should be a reality that very likely you won't understand the whole. I think why we're in the trouble that we're in is that we've had a belief system largely predicated on logic and rationalization that's determined in a very narrow way, which says just the opposite. You know, if you look at sort of the religious belief systems, sort of the Western belief systems, which I'll lump together just for simplicity, not necessarily for theological accuracy, it comes from this deterministic way of thinking and saying, you know, man, and I'm using man on purpose because these things were written with man as male, as the center of them, has dominance over quote unquote the natural world. So it starts off with the separation of humans from the world that we inhabit and actually puts us at the center of it to dominate and control as we see fit because we have a divine right to do so. And all of our social and economic systems spin out from that sort of thinking. And those themselves are connected, like they roll around with one another. So when you begin to think that you can solve every problem and that you have deterministic solutions, you can continue on roads of extraction because you always think there's some magic device, some MacGuffin that's going to solve your problem. And so you see a lot of that in unserious climate change talk. And when I say unserious climate change talk, it's the talk of, you know, corporate guardians, people who believe that, you know, oh, we can just keep doing and acting the same way because we'll find a way to take the salt out of ocean water and we'll be able to drink it and we'll find some.
Yeah, it's still reductionistic thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll disappear the garbage. You know, of course I can buy whatever I want from a extractive organization like Amazon and have it delivered to me in 2 days because I really needed that thing, you know? And so it continues on and on and on in that manner.
It inspires me to think about the famous Albert Einstein quote, logic will take you from A to B and imagination will take you everywhere. As long as we keep thinking in that reductionistic way and trying to explain our behaviors in a very rational fashion, kind of to redeem ourselves or kind of to act as if we're not the cause of anything, then we're still in the A to B mentality. Whereas we really need to get imaginative. We really need to be creative about how can we look at this differently? You know my business partner, Alberto Barreiro, and you and I and Alberto have worked together previously. And Alberto likes to talk about eccentricity, which I think he really reconnected me to that word. When he talks about eccentric people, he means people off the mainstream, off the center of gravitational center of how culture works. And these are, the court jesters of the former kings. The men, as you call them, the kings did not allow anyone else other than philosophers and deep thinkers and the court jesters to come in. And these eccentric people are the ones to provide the cultural counterpoint that actually reinstates that the mainstream culture is there. Because if you don't have a counterpoint, then what's the point in the first place? And your new book talks about revolutionaries. And I'd be intrigued to learn more about that. How do you look at revolution? How do you look at different, being diverse, being eccentric, being imaginative? How does that tie in together?
Yeah, it's cliche to say that one needs to question everything, but you do need to look at these systems, you know, the way the world operates, and we have to question everything that's happening around us. You know, we have to question all of our assumptions. And I think revolutionaries that's what they do. You know, that's what culture does. Culture, I say this all the time in my work, culture exists on the margins. It's right. The people who are not included in the central conversation that question why the world is operating the way in which it's operating. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're comfortable, then you don't really need to question things, right? Because the system is working as designed. You have your needs are met. They're likely exceeded. So why would you wake up and say, oh, you know what? This really isn't working for me, right? And revolutionaries do the opposite. They're often confronted with realities that are untenable. And so in order to make them livable, in some cases, in order to survive, they need to have a revolution. And that only comes with questioning the status quo.
Right, right. But revolution also often indicates that we need to act. And I'm also, as a practical guy, I'm really interested in what your definition of transformation is and how this translates to action. How would you formulate that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think there's going to be many definitions for a word like transformation, and particularly because we use it so often, right? It's probably one of those often used, overused words, right? With innovation, right? Like right. We all know what those words are that we hear all the time in our various word salads. I'm as guilty of that as anyone else, right. Probably more so because I talk a lot for a living, but nonetheless, my definition of transformation is quite simple. It's to, you know, move from one state to another. Mm-hmm. And with that kind of pithy definition, I actually look around and see very little transformation. I think what people call transformation are like, you know, we live in like an add-on / plug-in culture for those who do anything with websites or anything mm-hmm. like that, where we're not really transforming things as much as we're, you know, just kind of adding something on to a thing we already know.
Yeah.
But there's no real sea change difference in how we're operating. Like Uber is not transformational, mm-hmm. and neither is Amazon. You know, and I'm just picking these companies as examples. I mean, they're both fairly terrible organizations, but I could swap in any number of other names. But these are organizations that people would say are like, oh, they're really transformational. And I'm like, not really. Like Amazon, if anything, a lot of these organizations have actually degraded our progress in many ways. But we sort of lost the beat as to the how. I think about that very much, like with, you know, these recent, at the time of us recording this, these space, so-called space races, you know, Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and any number of, you know, extractive colonial settlers who are deemed as, you know, masters of the universe because they can fly slightly above an airplane, you know, but if you listen and contextualize that within the media, they will say these recent misadventures are transformational. And I'm like, they're regressive.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're repeating more of the same because it's the only thing they know, which ties back to the imagination. This is highly unimaginative.
Yeah. And they're actually worse. They're like none of what they're doing, outside of the fact that it's done by extractive folks, because I won't even say private, right? Like they've taken resources from the public sphere through their exploitation of their workers, exploitation of the rules of tax and all the things that they do to have, you know, gathered their wealth and then putting it into projects that we've already done. I've seen people really go to space and that wasn't that.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that they probably actually believe that they are doing good, or that they are transforming something for the world, and that's where probably the problem lies as well, that the belief systems are also really messed up in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely, and the problem is that we reinforce that the belief system becomes a loop because like I said, I watch the media crow about these people, right? They're covered widely and there's no really deep questioning of does any of this mean anything? You know, we're living on a planet that is literally on fire or underwater, depending on where you are.
Right.
And we will have people celebrate lunatics that that are going, you know, on pleasure jaunts.
Right. So what's behind that? What drives people to seek and perhaps even find meaning in these endeavors? Because I was triggered by something you just said about they lost the beat. And musically speaking, obviously these people are dancing to their own drum. But what is that is entrancing all of the others to kind of, you know, bounce their heads and feet to that music? I mean, what's going on here?
I mean, I think the system is seductive, right? And, you know, it's tough to continue to use words like system because it sounds so like, you know, mysterious and often conspiratorial. And that's not really ground I like to tread in. But I think those who are likely listening to your show have a broader understanding of those words. So they understand it. Like, you know, many things are a system. The fact that I can go to my kitchen sink and turn it on and magically water comes out because there's a plumbing and sanitation system that allows, you know, somewhat clean water to come out of my tap, right? So system in the way I'm using it is not meant to mean anything more than, you know, an operational context. But I think to answer your question, these things are seductive. You know, I was seduced by them. You know, I had a career on Wall Street that was solely predicated on making money. Mm-hmm. You know, I was 27 years old, 25, 27 years old. And I looked at the world and I said, this is the thing that will allow me to make the most money because I have no other discernible talent. You know, I can't catch or throw or kick a ball. I can't act. I can't sing. And a Wall Street career is the, you know, and this is before like the VC sort of Silicon Valley model. But in my mind, that was the place where I could make the most money given what I knew to do. That's a seductive framework.
Right.
You know, you have to actively work against that framework. But when you're in a zero sum world, then anything you lose, you perceive as never being able to get it back.
Right.
And so unless you build different levels of community, different ways of creating value, different ways of supporting one another, you will always be in that loop. And America, because I'm sitting in America, is the pinnacle of that because it is a nation rooted in deep systemic violence, and it continues to perpetrate that violence by the way in which it operates on a day-to-day basis because it forces its citizens to have a completely selfish and individualistic way of thinking, which is like a working death cult.
Yeah. We've touched upon some of those things just now on topics like object and subject. So really turning everything around us into an object with no emotion or feelings of any kind. We've talked about how individual our culture has become. But I think that to your point that we have to actively work against it, I'm turning and I'm leaning more towards we have to actively build community. We have to actively reestablish relationships so that we can start amassing a critical mass that will give kind of the countercultural meaning that people seem to be seeking. Because in a way, it's not just about being critical, but how do we envision and how do we create something that is alluring and seductive in a different way? So that I think that people are searching, you know, it's like the prisoner's dilemma, right? So they're watching the shadows on the side of the cave and no one's turning around towards the light. So as a culture, and America is really quite plays a decisive role in terms of shaping culture in the Western world. How do we as a culture break that trance and move forward? I, for one, and still perhaps speaking about it individualistically here, sitting here with Marco, we need that, man. We're searching for that. That's one of the reasons for this podcast, actually.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Tell us something from an anthropological perspective.
Exactly. It's good that you're an anthropologist.
Yeah, I think relationships are important, but I think it's also important to understand that we are in relationships, mm-hmm. right? Like we have to actively choose different types of relationships, right? Right now mm-hmm. we're in an abusive relationship mm. and we need to break that model. And it can be broken in big ways and it can be broken in small ways, but we need to act.
Yeah.
Differently, and then, you know, like I always say, I lead with do no harm. I want to enter into the world, enter into spaces and leave them better than I walked into them.
Right.
And I lead with trust that came up in this conversation at the very beginning. And I lead with love. You know, I don't have a lot of time to like debate things or like get into the weeds about a lot of stuff that people would consider just the normal course of action, you know, like on a practical sense. If I'm working on something and someone says, hey Phil, you know, this is my budget, that's your budget, right? Like I'm not debating with you. I'm not like, cause I'm leading with trust. If you're someone that I feel is not there to exploit me, you're not there to do hard work. If you tell me you have $100, you got $100.
Right.
You know, like I'm not getting into these places where, and conversely, if I'm hiring somebody and they tell me their rate, I'm like, okay. In some cases I've been like, that's too low. And I'm actually paying you this. Right. Cause I also know what I have. Right.
Yeah.
And so if I know I have $5,000 and someone, you know, gives me a quote and they're like, oh, you know, Phil, I can do this thing you need done for $2,000. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be like, I don't know about that, dude. Like if it's, you know, let me give you more than that if I have it.
Yeah.
And we have to change the way we operate on a very practical sense and break these abusive relationships and turn them into supportive communal relationships that are rooted in trust and are rooted in love rather than exploitation and extraction.
And how do we do that? So on the one hand, how do we start new relationships on what basis? Eh? So which shared values, apart from just trust and love? I guess there are many others that we can think of that people also have to relate to then. And if we do also leave that abusive relationship, under what terms do we leave?
Yeah, I think the terms in which we leave abusive relationships have to be absolute, or you're still in an abusive relationship, mm-hmm. maybe just to a different degree.
Right.
And the negotiation of the new relationship happens all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, that's the big and small back and forth. It's, you know, it's very practical because I get the chance to do it every day. You know, every person that I come in contact with, I have a choice in the manner in which I treat them. Mm-hmm. You know, every business decision I make, I have a decision to enter into a particular type of contract, to do a particular type of work. I think the one thing that works against us is this, again, that sort of deterministic notion that, oh, well, it's all rigged and it doesn't really matter and there's no way to change it. And all of those, that deep cynicism that's rooted in the way capitalism operates is what keeps capitalism alive, you know? And I think about like Ursula Le Guin is someone that I admire and respect. Mm-hmm. And I quote her all the time where she's like, you know, 500 years ago, we couldn't see past the divine rule of kings. Mm-hmm. You know, if we walked around and told people that, you know, 500 to 600 years ago, someone like Queen Elizabeth II would have been considered literally a divine ruler.
Right.
They would say that's absurd. Mm-hmm. Even the English would say that's absurd. So these anything can change. You know, the fact that we are in an exploitive, extractive system, it's not a natural system. It's not gravity. We've made these rules so we can make different rules.
It's not a natural system. Wonderful way of putting that. Still, and continuing on what Marco was saying, to make it even more deeply practical and perhaps provoke you and tickle you a bit with that, people have families, they've got homes, they've got mouths to feed and future, you know, futures to worry about if that's people's hobby then. And so shunning cynicism is really hard to do. It's not something that people can just flip a switch. So what are ways of doing that? How can we perhaps from our place be supportive in helping that happen? Where does one start? What should we advise our listeners?
I think you start, you know, I feel like I'm going to say kind of the same thing. So I apologize for those who feel like I might be trying to avoid the issue, but I really do see it like as a really practical thing that we all live in communities. Some of us live in communities of invisibility where we're in geographic proximity, but we're not in community proximity, really. And I think about how I grew up, it wasn't that way. Like everybody I knew was part of this immigrant community. Mm-hmm. I've never lived more than like, I don't know. At one point in my life, I lived further because they moved to Florida. But in a New York context, I've never lived more than like 15 minutes away from like some of the closest people in my life. And we supported each other. You know, my aunt got my mom a job when she was working in a department store and got her into like a union job, you know, because she had a union job and it was a place where she could like pull people in. You know, we cooked for each other, mm-hmm. you know, we babysat for each other. Like all the things that I look around and say that are killing people, killing families, we did together as a community.
That's, you know, amazing.
My landlords, they were, I'll never forget these folks. They lived the building that my family lived in Brooklyn, and Polish family, you know, Jewish family, and Mrs. Scalas, you know, she owned the building. Her son lived in the back. We lived above them. Yeah. And she would take care of me and my sister before, when my mom went to work and before my dad came home. You know, we're taking you downstairs to Mrs. Scalas. And she was our landlord. You know, she was just a little old lady. Then we sat there at her table and we did our homework. She gave us some candy. And then, you know, my dad picked us up on the way home. Like that allowed my parents to save money, right? They weren't exploiting them on rent. And then they were able to buy a house that my parents still live in. Like these things are all possible. They're not maybe these grand things that people will read about in design books and systems thinking books, but they're deeply human things that make differences.
That's
and
beautiful.
We've broken those things. And so that's why we increasingly flounder.
Yeah,
we can't find a way to even do the most basic things because we don't truly have a community around us.
So is that what we lost? The sense of proximity or something in this digital age? Why are we not able to get that back?
I don't know if it's a digital age, though. I mean, recently we were working on a project with a client and it was on the topic of leadership and kind of leading from within. And people had to make an assessment. And I suggested within our work group, so on the agency side, I suggested people should ask five people around them, friends and family. And someone said people don't have five in their friends, what they would call friends and family. Wow. And I was in shock.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a digital thing. I am the daughter of a workaholic mom. I think in the 80s, children were, I mean, luckily it's not my case, but a lot of people with working parents were very alienated. We used to have here in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. you call them latchkey kids, right? Something like this, little kinder.
Yeah.
Right. So at some point, it became an issue of survival, it seems to me. And then the digital age actually enhanced connection, but it kind of resignified it in a way that's wrong. But
But right. at least like now, if you've a latchkey kid that is at home and needs to know something, they can probably send a direct message to one of their parents or caregivers and find kind of solutions. But it's still, now it's in the rational domain, right. not the emotional domain.
That's true.
I don't know.
But you don't really have a sense of proximity because you don't really see the effects of the contact that you have with that person. So I was wondering about that. So somebody feels closer, but they actually aren't. So the fact that your mother got a job is because your aunt was really near to her. She could see the effect of that. She didn't have that job.
We're emotional beings after all.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, digital is gift and curse, right? It's allowing us to do this. Right. It's allowing us to kind of magically move from one place to another through space and time and do things like these podcasts and maintain relationships. You know, I work with people all over the world, and in a very practical matter, that would be impossible if I didn't have these tools, Wi-Fi, you know, and, you know, all WhatsApp and all the rest of it. Right. So technology in and of itself can't make us kind of do one thing or another, because I always push back on that premise, because I'm like, well, what's technology, right? Like, that's also one of the things that I think we need to confront. Like, does technology only look like AI and, you know, all the things we've kind of already talked about? Can technology look like something else, right? Like, is fire technology in the way we think about it anymore? Of course not, right? Is the wheel, right? But if you remove those things, all the rest of these things, again, that are add-ons, that are plug-ons, that are plug-ins rather, they don't even work, right? So I think we really need to rethink what we already know to be true.
Right.
Like, the answers are already there because we've seen other ways of being, right? We just don't really want to fully engage with them for whatever the many reasons are. And, you know, to go back to the beginning, it's complex, right? It's not going to be just one thing. It's going to be any number of interlocking things that are kind of moving at different times and ebbs and flows. And that's what makes it so hard to untangle, right? Because it's not just going to be any one of them. And I think our nature is to kind of look for the thing, right? Like, oh, if we can just push this lever or, you know, push that button, then we can kind of reset this. And I think we need to be operating on multiple fronts. And not all of us are going to lead that charge, right? Like, there are things I'm patently not good at or I know nothing about, right? So a part of what I need to do is just be humble enough to say that. Like, hey, you know what? I don't really know how that works. So maybe I need some other fellow humans to kind of tackle that piece of it, right? And I kind of really know how this works, or at least I'm willing to go down the road to discover more about how it works. So I'm going to spend my time here, right? Like, I think we need to understand that we're not all going to be able to solve everything. And that's why you see the Elon Musk of the world. And, you know, again, these people are just examples. They're not the only villains, right? They're just the villains that most of us all know. They think that because they have capacity in one thing, that they can also just transfer that into something else, right? Like, oh, I'm really good at like building electric cars, so I can also go to Mars, right? It's like,
and perhaps that answers the question about what is it that is entrancing people. Is there's a lot of pressure on Elon Musk to get it right, because a lot of people get hopeful for the wrong reasons, but they seem to be looking for the Messiah, the one person that's going to find the answer, and then we will all be saved.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the story, right? Like, so many of these stories, because we're all learned from stories, big and small, right? Is that, you know, there's one singular genius. That singular genius is usually a man. He's usually white. and he can solve the problem, right? If we if we empower these people and kind of hit the switch and let them go, they might have some bumps and bruises, but they'll likely end up in a place that makes the world better, right? Like, we hear this all the time. And for someone like myself, you know, a Black man sitting in Brooklyn, that's a narrative that clearly has never been true, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's just something that, again, when the world isn't working for you, you ask questions. And I'm like, well, these people seem to be the cause of all the problems. Mm-hmm. I find it hard to believe that they can be also the solution. Automatically, for large parts of the world, those narratives don't make any sense anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so that's what we need to push back against, is like, why are we even talking about these people outside of to point out really just how destructive they really are?
So if we imagine this future, how do we get there, and how do we get the order of the steps in the right sequence? Can you enlighten us a little bit and, you know, just use 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Yeah, enlighten is a heavy word.
Okay, sorry. Can you inform us?
Yeah, inform sounds a lot better.
No, what do you think?
Just
what
hand the plan over. Come on, Phil.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And you have to look at the right problems, like you just mentioned with Elon Musk. I mean, there are a lot of scientists say it's ridiculous because we're looking at Mars, even though the worst place to live in the world. Antarctica is actually more livable than Mars. So why is he focusing on that? Right?
Right. And, you know, I can go on and on about that thinking. Like, it's such, I mean, it's sad because it's so like just ridiculous on its face that I find it shocking that anyone takes these people seriously.
But Phil, like, aren't you being rational about that? Which part of your brain finds it shocking? Like, look into your heart, man. Be compassionate. I think that people are really looking for hope as an answer. Yeah. Darn it. I wish they would kind of, you know, snap out of it, just like you're thinking. But it's just, you know, the whole issue is that all of this is so, makes you feel so little. And some people might experience that as humbling and scratch their heads and say, hey, we need to give this another take. But perhaps other people feel, you know, slightly depressed and disempowered and not knowing what to do. So they seek the help from outside. The example you gave us is absolutely beautiful about seeking help from outside, because when it's in close community, when it's in close proximity, when it involves looking each other in the face or giving each other a hug if we need one, then of course we need the others, very, very much so. But there is also this kind of going back to the abusive relationship, right? So if you're in your abusive relationship, you sort of lick your wounds and patch your bruises and look up again and say, this time it's going to be wonderful, right? that's what I'm pointing at. And it's saddening, but also it requires us a certain compassion, like saying, oh my gosh, these people cannot see through the wackiness of it all. So it's, I think that to Marco's point just now, it involves a multiplicity of people. It involves a multiplicity of initiatives and perhaps, dare I say, experiments. But also, kind of the clock is ticking on us. Where are we going to go? So how do we kind of coordinate a coherence from trust that actually creates more trust? Or in other words, what is your rallying call to the revolutionaries out there?
Well, I think we need to be humbled. We need to understand how the natural world works. Because if the more you understand about the natural world and how connected we are to it, the more absurd the idea of moving off this planet will truly become. You know, you couldn't live in Antarctica, but some creatures do. So Antarctica is not inhospitable, it's exactly inhospitable to humans. But hundreds of species thrive in Antarctica, whales and seals and all kinds of stuff. right? Yeah. But when we put ourselves at the center of that story, we're like, exactly. Oh, Antarctica is just a wasteland. How?
Yeah.
Right? Like we need Antarctica to survive, right? That's why it's such an existential threat that it's melting. Right. I'm pushing back against those ideas because it's not about, there's so much imagination here in the world that we are in because we don't understand it at all.
Right.
Because if we did, we wouldn't treat it like we do. It's because we don't understand it that we treat it like we do. So I'm not against exploration or all that kind of stuff. It's that the argument I'm making against those people, and again, these are just the villains we know. There's tons of villains out there that we don't know, right? What they're professing as knowledge isn't truly knowledge.
Right.
You know, they're professing like this sort of play acting at knowledge. And we've, again, lost the beat so much, we can't distinguish between the two.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge. We need to, you know, they frame their false innovation by the fact that, oh, we're going to the stars, right? But they don't appreciate those stars because we create a planet that blots them out.
Yeah. So
with the light from our cities.
Yeah. So what you're referring to is also what deep ecology does, really this deep questioning of understanding nature so that we see ourselves as part of it and instead of the center of it. And the good news is that we promised our audience also no answers to it's just what we because also in my mind now more questions pop up talking to you, Phil. But so thank you for that for generating those questions.
Absolutely.
We entitled this podcast "Dear Future, I'm Ready." And we always ask our interviewee to complete the sentence, "Dear future, I'm ready." Could you also tell us what you feel most ready for by completing the sentence, "Dear future, I'm ready"?
Dear future, I'm ready to love. Everything starts with love. It's the most powerful emotion that we have.
Nice.
Wow.
Thank you, Phil.
What's the song that goes with that?
I guess we'll have to write one. I think the world, the one thing the world doesn't have a shortage of is love songs.
That's true.
Amazing.
But we can always create another one.
Of course, yes.
We can always create another one. And one is being created right now. We just don't know it yet.
Well, we'll put a beat under this one.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Phil, for having the conversation with us and spending time with us.
It's been, you totally exceeded my expectations. So thanks so much.
Oh, I couldn't have asked for a better way to start my morning since we're recording this in the morning in New York time. And I deeply appreciate this opportunity and both of you and your work. And I couldn't have asked for more. I really humbly, humbly appreciate it.
Dear future.
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 Dear future, I'm ready.
This is Dear Future, I'm Ready.
Dear future, I'm ready.
Thank you for listening to Dear Future, I'm Ready. Curious about our next or previous episodes? Please find us on digitalsocietyschool.org or on your favorite podcast or music platform under Dear Future, I'm Ready, and subscribe today. Are you or your team interested in really getting hands-on with the practice of transformation design, sustainability by design, or diversity and inclusion? Check out our professional courses on digitalsocietyschool.org and sign up today for one of our truly transformational learning experiences. For help at an organizational level, check out Transformational Studio, a transformation design agency with the aim of revolutionizing change through design and making transformation irresistible. Check them out at transformation.studio.